Could America be both stronger and safer, even while maybe spending half as much as we currently do on national defense? That's a question we're going to tackle today on today's episode of Independent Conversations. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And on this session of Independent Conversations, I am delighted to welcome Ivan Eland. Ivan Eland is the director of our Center on Peace and Liberty and is a senior fellow here at Independent Institute. Welcome, Ivan.
Thanks for having me on, Graham.
You've got a fascinating new book coming out now, and we want to talk about it a little bit. But first, let me remind our friends that Dr. Ivan Eland has been around the block a few times. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ivan, you worked on Capitol Hill for the Congress for a total of some 16 years between Congressional Budget Office and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Have I got that right?
Right. 16 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Could be mind-numbing, or you could have learned a great deal. Probably both, huh?
Yeah, pretty both. I was usually in a nonpartisan role for all those years, so I saw both sides of the political battle and, you know, how things work in Congress and that sort of thing. And I also got a hefty dose of how the executive branch operates. In fact, I got so much of a dose that I became a libertarian.
Okay. Well, you learn from experience then. You've also been quite active in public news media. You've been published in USA Today, Los Angeles Times. You've been on an interesting combination of broadcast media, including on the one hand, Fox News, and on the other hand, NPR and PBS and CNN and so forth. You're kind of a bipartisan commentator, and we appreciate that. You're also the author of a number of earlier books. I can't even list them all, but among the most popular is your book, War and the Rogue Presidency. And then there's the one called Recarving Rushmore. People love that one because you ranked the presidents on peace and prosperity and liberty issues. So if you're like a U.S. history buff and you want to read about the presidents, you should go to Ivan Eland's book, Recarving Rushmore, or his other book, 11 Presidents, which also assesses the presidents in different ways. But now I'd like to talk about this new book, which is called Balance of Titans. And I'm going to show our friends what the cover of the book looks like so that they can take a peek for themselves. Here it is. It's called Balance of Titans, Peace and Liberty in the New Multipolar World, from Independent Institute. And I welcome everybody's interest in this book. So let's talk about it for a little bit here, Ivan. In this book, you propose a really new way of structuring American strategic and military interests and America's posture. But this leads me to a very preliminary question, Ivan. If a new American defense or military posture is needed, it begs the question, well, what's wrong with the current one?
Well, the current one we've had since 1947, I would say probably since 1945, and that is we're a superpower and we get involved everywhere in every continent, whether it's strategic to the U.S., meaning vital to our security, or not. And, you know, some examples have been, you know, getting involved in Africa during the 80s and 90s in brush fire wars. And we really had no strategic interest in there. You could even say that the strategic interest in the Middle East is overwrought and certainly hasn't been reassessed since the fracking boom happened in the United States. So these things, the question is, we're on autopilot and could we do something better? And I say we could be more restrained. And this is not a really a new idea. For most of U.S. history, in fact, since the founding to 1947, let's say 47, that's when the Cold War started, supposedly. And so we have had a policy of military restraint. It was always thought that we shouldn't really get involved in wars if we didn't have to. And we got involved in World War I and World War II, but we came in
late. It took
late.
A lot to persuade the American public to get into those two wars.
Especially after World War I, which is a meat grinder. I mean, we lost people at a rate higher than even World War II, but we weren't there that long because he came in late. But then the population, everyone always says, well, you know, we should have stopped Hitler before, you know, he overran Europe or what, you know, if we had stayed. I heard one commentator say, well, if we'd stayed after World War I, we wouldn't have had a World War II. And I say to that, the American public was fed up with it because they were lied to about the purpose of the war. And maybe in Woodrow Wilson's mind, the war was about making the world safe for democracy. But in reality, his allies were scheming behind him to expand their empires, which is what they did after World War I. And also, people didn't like the tremendous casualties because they'd never seen casualties like that since the Civil War. And so they were very reluctant to get into World War II. And there was a very good reason for that.
You know, what's fascinating is that you're arguing that we need a new strategic defense posture. But new really means in contrast to the U.S. defense posture since 1947, since the Cold War era, because before that, the U.S. had been much more, stingy in its involvement overseas. I'm thinking back, there's a few little data points I have in my mind. President Washington, at the end of his second term, warned about entangling alliances and being careful. We had the Monroe Doctrine under President Monroe, but that was just about keeping those European powers out of the Western Hemisphere. It seemed like a very limited aspiration militarily. The aspiration embodied in U.S. strategy from 47 forward was a lot more expansive, right? I mean, what was the vision that animated U.S. strategic and military policy starting in 1947? What was the vision that animated it?
Well, Truman took an expansive cut at the Cold War by saying that we were going to help any country that was, you know, being basically overrun by communists, even if it was a small country way away from the strategic zones that the U.S. had been doing, which was mainly the Caribbean and the Pacific before that. That was our, you know, it was basically, you know, the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the Pacific. And that didn't mean Korea or Vietnam or Philippines. It meant, you know, the Pacific near the United States, the Atlantic near the United States, and then Caribbean. And Truman decided to go on a worldwide crusade against communism. Now, nobody likes communism, but the question is, do we really need to do all that and, you know, bear any burden, pay any price, as JFK later said? But that was like just a continuation of the Truman Doctrine. And this took the U.S. into several quagmires, Vietnam. And the Korean turned out to be a quagmire after 3 years when it was a stalemate because we had to maintain our forces there, et cetera. So
a stalemate that's still maintained today.
Right, right. It's still, technically, there's still a war, the two parties. But anyway, this is expansion was more because we could rather than we should have. And the reason for that is after World War II, we had 50% of the world's GDP. And because all the other powers had been, you know, at least debilitated by the war.
So it's the response to the situation at the end of World War II. It's the response to Soviet Union. It seems like the aggressive forward-focused U.S. posture has also been enhanced by a series of events around the world where U.S. power was deployed for good ends. I mean, obviously, there was 9/11 and the need to react to the Afghanistan-based forces that took out the two towers. But that became very much a war for nation building and spreading democracy. And then, of course, there was events in the Horn of Africa, events in other parts of the world where various U.S. presidents decided that we should use our power to do good, to save people from humanitarian disasters, save people from tyrannical governments, build democracy in the Middle East and so forth. These were all other ways in which it wasn't just a opposition to communism, but also aspiration to moral expansion. That moral vision seems to be part and parcel of the greatly expanded military posture that you're objecting to. Is that right?
Well, the moral posture is within the American people. I think they want a moral foreign policy. But the problem comes with that, that the politicians will do any intervention and then dress it up as a moral crusade about whatever they're doing. In the Cold War, it was communism. The problem was communism would have fallen eventually by its own devices. And that's what everybody said, including George Kennan. We were supposed to contain it until it fell of its own contradictions. And the question in the Cold War was not, were we anti-communist? It's, did we have to get involved in, you know, peripheral areas? The main, you know, assets that we were trying to protect was Western Europe and Japan. And the reason for that was because they were developed countries. They had, you know, strong economies before the war, and they were capable of, as history has proven out, they're capable of creating strong economies after the war, because they were not as controlled as a lot of other countries in the world, their economies, that is. And so if we had stuck to that, you know, there would be a better reason for what we did during the Cold War. But I think things got a little out of hand. And of course, this, as you just pointed out, this idea that we were going to take democracy at the point of a gun, that's not really how this works effectively. It very rarely works that way. And it hasn't worked in Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya. These are just recent ones. Vietnam and Korea, it worked where our troops were, but of course it didn't work when our troops were pushed back to the demilitarized zone. It didn't work in North Korea. So this is, you know, I think democracy and free markets sort of have to bubble up from the bottom, and other countries have to, I think the best thing that the U.S. can do is be a good example for other countries in both, you know, free, we, and of course we can always do better ourselves on freeing markets and, you know, having Republican principles here at home.
So Truman and then Eisenhower, the great mastermind of the World War II victory, became president. But Eisenhower tossed up a flare, you might say, at the end of his presidency when he gave that famous speech warning about the development of the military-industrial complex. But Kennedy didn't seem to take that warning too much into account, nor did Johnson, nor did Nixon, et cetera. But looking back at Eisenhower, he had that one moment of clarity, real clarity, about the buildup of this thing, which he called the military-industrial complex. In your book, you seem to be taking a certain cue from Eisenhower and adding another word onto the end of military-industrial complex. You say, well, tell us your term for the thing.
Military-industrial congressional complex.
Congressional. Okay, because Congress is complicit. Explain what that means.
Well, Congress, there, another way to look at it is what's called iron triangles. And iron triangles are when, let's start with how the military-industrial complex arose. I try to be very quick. Most wars in U.S. history, when the war was over, our industrial base went back to producing commercial items, which it produced before the war. In other words, they converted to military production, converted back to civilian production. Well, in World War II, we needed so much production. We spent 44% of our GDP was military during World War II because it was a massive war. Well, after the war, a lot of the rural areas and suburban areas and exurban areas, their economies, you know, were falling into a recession, and the cities were a bit more flexible in what they could produce, but they started, instead of reconverting or doing the best they could, they started lobbying their congressional people to, oh, well, we need to keep defense spending high. And so then fortunately for the military-industrial complex, which was then in its incipient stage of this idea that we need to keep defense as an economic, for economic reasons rather than strictly security reasons, the Korean War happened. And then after that, as Eisenhower pointed out during his term, it really expanded. And this idea that the military has these needs but the Congress wants the jobs, so they lobby to get the military lobbies Congress to get more money, and then you have the industrial interests or the economic interests in the particular district or state that are also lobbying for that. And Congress said, the Congress people say, well, you know, I'm all for security, especially when it's produced in my district or state, and therefore you get overproduction of defense goods, which, and they have a very low competition in the defense industry because it's heavily shielded from competition. And one of my things is that I think that we could do better, at least at the subcontractor level, by encouraging non-defense contractors to get involved in defense contracting, so we have more competition there, because we have the military industrial complex is very inefficient. The most weapons are behind schedule, cost overruns galore, and the performance declines as the contract proceeds. In other words, they have goals of performance, cost, and schedule, and they don't meet any of them usually.
Yeah. I'm thinking of this term, this word complex, which Eisenhower used and which you're also using. It speaks to us of the ways in which the entire military production process and all the corporate interests around it, which are shielded from typical market forces, are interpenetrated in American public and political life in such a way that members of Congress have a built-in self-interest to build up these military contractors. And the whole thing, Eisenhower warned, was going to be create a permanent penetration into American life that we'd never seen before. And so this is, I think we've kind of gotten to an answer to my basic question from the start, which was, so you want to change U.S. military and strategic posture. What was wrong with the current one? Well, I think we're seeing it. It's vastly penetrated civilian society. It's cronyistic. It gets involved in wars and conflicts elsewhere that can't be won and that don't serve their purpose, that is antagonizes populations in other parts of the world. Is that kind of a good summary of what's wrong with the current setup?
Yeah, that's a very good summary. And I would just add one more thing. Eisenhower himself said in his speech, it was a threat to liberty here at home. And, you know, I think we're seeing that now a bit because, you know, the military is now being used for law enforcement. And this is nothing new. The drug war goes back to Nixon and that sort of thing. But we're seeing it, again, used for law enforcement. And it's not built to do that. And the National Guard really isn't built to do that unless there's a real big emergency that local law and state law enforcement can't take care of. So but I think that, the basic problem is nobody has an alternative to this. And that's what my book really tries to do.
Exactly.
To come up with a more modest list of vital interests and what forces we need to guard those vital interests, and then what weapons we need and what amount of money we need to spend. And I do sort of I start at the bottom and work my way up
to a
funding level.
You actually have detailed funding proposals for how we could get from here to a better there, which is pretty unique in this book. But I want to notice one key thing before I move on to some of those concrete suggestions about rolling back the expenditures. You reach back prior to Truman for some inspiration to an unlikely source, namely Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, I'm used to people being critical of Roosevelt. I'm usually myself critical of Roosevelt. But you point out in this book, which is called A Balance of Titans, by the way, everybody who wants to take up the book and get a copy of it. In A Balance of Titans, you point out that FDR talked about a concept called the four policemen, which could have been the alternative future instead of the Cold War. What did FDR have in mind? Why did you look back to FDR's four policemen, and how did you change his idea a little bit?
Well, of course, FDR was disastrous in, you know, expanding government in the domestic sphere during the Depression. And he was also, I think, got off on a bad track of putting so much into the UN, the United Nations. And that took him away from this four policemen that he was originally thinking about, because he was starting to think about, as the war went on, it was obvious that the Allies were going to eventually win it, since they had so much GDP and things were going badly for Hitler and the Japanese and the Italians. So he said, well, okay, what do we do after the war? And he was saying, well, you know, Stalin, and everybody knew Stalin was a murderer just like Hitler was, but FDR said, well, you know, we're going to have to manage the world after this thing is over. And, you know, I've met this guy several times, and he doesn't seem like he wants to be that as aggressive as Lenin was. So maybe we can have a confluence of power. We can have Britain, Soviet Union, and the U.S., and maybe China, about those four policemen. And we can, and of course, China was still a, there was a bit hopeful about China at the time. But he came up with this, why don't we have spheres of influence and everybody police their own sphere? Obviously, the U.S. has the Western Hemisphere. It was already doing that with the Monroe Doctrine since 1823. And, you know, the Soviet Union had a big tank army in the middle of Europe after the war in eastern part of Germany. And there was going to be no, FDR was very pragmatic. He knew that moving that Red Army out was not what we wanted to do after 4 years of war. So he wanted to have some cooperation among the great powers, but also increasing the chances that that would work. He wanted to have everybody have a zone of influence. So
an acknowledged zone.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then, you know, you can argue about where the boundary is. And I think we're seeing that in Ukraine now. But this idea... But then, of course, Truman came in, and he was a big hawk. And the FDR wasn't really very clear about, because of the idealistic Americans, this Yalta agreement that he got with Stalin. Stalin was going to take over Eastern Europe because the Red Army was sitting there. And the Red Army sat there until Gorbachev came in, right?
Right.
And so...
As they say, a possession is 9/10 of the law.
Right. I mean, people say, well, we shouldn't have let him have it. You know, and Patton wanted to go after the Russians. And everyone's going like, you know, the Russians just defeated Hitler and they got a massive army. And no, we're not going to do that. Right. So unless you wanted to go after the Red Army after we finished off Hitler, there probably had to be some cooperation. But of course, then Roosevelt died and Truman took over, and no one told Truman that this was, you know, this is what really FDR was resigned to this, but he couldn't tell the American people because he was not a very honest guy. So Truman comes in and said, no, you know, we're going to do this worldwide, pushback on communism because we can't let it, you know, the domino theory at the time, which also went through Vietnam. It kind of ended in Vietnam when it really didn't go that far. But one communist country would then be used as a base to turn the next one to communism, turn the next one to communism, blah, blah, blah. So, but no one ever asked, how strategic are these places? And I think they even knew in JFK and LBJ's time during the Vietnam War that Vietnam was not very strategic, but they were scared because Truman had been criticized. The one key thing that ran through Democratic politics for a long time that the Republicans used to hammer on the Democrats was that Truman lost China. And that's why he went into Korea, because Korea at the time was a very poor country and was not strategic. In fact, the military had already pulled out of South Korea just before this happened. And so, but Truman went in there because he was haunted by this supposedly losing communism. But I'm not sure what people wanted him to do about it, because there was a big civil war there. So then the same thing happened in Vietnam. So you see this historical legacy throughout the Cold War.
So there was a fleeting moment toward the end of the Roosevelt era when this vision of four policemen might have blossomed. But instead, we went back to one policeman in the United States because the U.S. had the overwhelmingly larger economy, resources, military, et cetera. Not four policemen, but one policeman. You're saying it's time to go back to, well, not four policemen, but what's your new idea that's reminiscent of the old Roosevelt idea?
Well, I think it's a multipolar world now. And rather than having countries gang up on us, which is what's happening now with China, Russia, and India, we were courting India as a counterweight to China, but the 50% tariffs that Trump put on. Modi went to that meeting like last week or so because to tell the Americans, you know, we've always been independent in India and we can, you know, go to the meeting with these other guys. So I think what we need to do really, because we have $37 trillion worth of debt, is we need to scale back what our vital interests are. Right now, they're the entire world, right? And that we're going to run into conflict with China, India, Russia, all those countries if we keep doing that. And I think we have to find a way to have a multi-centered world. You know, the EU can be one pole, the US can be one pole, Russia, China, India. And I would say within Europe, of course, UK, France would be the great powers that would be leading that area. And then you have Japan over on the Far East, who has a very capable military and a developed economy. So,
and did you mention Brazil?
Well, Brazil maybe in the future. I don't think Brazil is there yet, but yes, they could police South America. But we really need to police the Caribbean. We always have, probably. But I don't really like the term policeman because I think that Hoover and FDR had one other very positive thing that Hoover started. He doesn't get any credit for. And FDR followed him in the good neighbor policy. And during when Hitler was rising, they were saying, well, you know, maybe we should have a better relationship with Latin America rather than acting so heavy-handed about it. And I think, you know, the old saying that your mother said, you get more with sugar than vinegar, I think it can be applied in politics. And, you know, obviously Vladimir Putin and some of these people aren't going to really agree with that. And we're going to have to stay out of some stuff that seems like it would be a great cause to get behind in other people's sphere of influence. But within our own sphere of influence, we can set a better tone a lot of the time than we have in the past. And, you know, we can lead, but we don't necessarily have to be heavy-handed militarily.
So there could be emerging, actually, as a kind of realistic necessity, 5 or 6, 7 spheres of influence around the world where there's a dominant power, and they're the ones. Each one of the other 6 of the 7 doesn't mess with that one sphere and vice versa. There's kind of a respect of these spheres of influence. It's an old idea, but doesn't it depend, Ivan, on somehow there being a reason why each dominant regional power should respect the sphere of influence of the others on the whole? Like, what would motivate them to respect the sphere of influence of the other sphere powers under this
vision?
Well,
I think you have to make this explicit. You know, we say we don't have a sphere of influence, which is absolutely nonsense, and that they're out of date, which they're not. We still have Latin America. I mean, Trump is down there intimidating Maduro, and certainly Maduro has ruined his country. But do we really need to do that? That's just a minor example. I would say we've done much worse than that in the past. But so we do have First of all, the sphere of influences are sort of traditional Eastern Europe, Russia, Western Europe, France, and Britain. And then you have China. And, you know, if we clearly delineate these two spheres up front and be explicit about it, saying this is what we're going to do, we're going to have the conclave of great powers.
Got it.
To, you know, we're not saying Russia's not a great power, China's, you know, they're like Russia, I think, is still trying to achieve to get back to great power status after the Soviet Union fell. And that's one of the problems, I think. We haven't, by expanding NATO east, we haven't acknowledged that they have a sphere of influence at all. We've ran it right up to the Russian border. And if Ukraine gets some sort of a security guarantee, which will essentially be a NATO security guarantee, then, you know, that's, Ukraine has always been very culturally, economically, and politically and militarily important to you, to Russia. So we're not really acknowledging Russia as a great power. And I think that's one problem we have. And China feels that we're containing it by all of our alliances surrounding it. So if we let these countries have their spheres of influence, and we, like we did in the old days, I mean, this is nothing new, as you point out, and I'm not saying that it is. We just have to kind of acknowledge that there's other powers in the world. And that's been kind of the norm throughout history. The Cold War, the superpower U.S., and the unipolar moment after the Cold War ended, those are kind of aberrations in history.
It appeals to me at this vision of like six regions or however many there are with sort of acknowledged supreme power in each one and not messing with the other ones. That's very appealing. I can see why it would lessen the need for U.S. Military expenditures and activity and so forth. It makes a lot of sense. But I just have one kind of caveat or question about it. This vision of like six spheres or whatever, doesn't it depend, doesn't the viability and stability of that multipolar balance thing, balance of powers, doesn't it depend upon the key participants having the mindset or, I don't know, the beliefs consistent with that? So for example, the old Soviet Union, was clearly driven by its ideological belief structure, which was that the Communist International, Comintern, had the destiny of overrunning the entire world for the sake of the proletariat. It was built into the DNA of that regime. So that regime is gone. The Putin regime is here. It's not a good regime, but it doesn't seem to have that same world appetite ideology that the Soviet Union has. So that's a good bodes well for your idea. But then there are others, like for example, what about the various Islamist internationalist states or proto-states? I mean, they're driven by a vision that their Sharia system should overtake the entire world. And I can't see a movement like that, for example. Maybe that's the Iranian vision. I can't see that kind of a vision being content to stay in its sphere of influence if there's a belief underlying the regime that's internationalist and unbounded in scope. What do you make of those objections?
Well, the Islamic example, it's the Islamic world reached its peak, you know, in the early in the first millennium, I think. And so, certainly, you're talking about the terrorist groups with this ideology, but most of the Islamic world doesn't believe in that ideology in the first place. In the second place, you have two competing ideologies, the radical ideologies, the Iranian Shia version and the Sunni Al-Qaeda version. And certainly, you have to have a will to do something, but you also have to have the capabilities. And these countries are just, don't have the resources to do anything like that. Now they can spawn terrorist groups or something, but that the terrorist groups usually attack the U.S. when we're over there in their regions, or they retaliate in our region because we've interfered so much in the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East has been the region, you know, since 1947 that we've intervened in the most in. So that's, some of that is blowback from there. But there are radical elements with this ideology, but I think they're a minority. And also, and some fundamentalist Islamic states like the Gulf Gulf states, they're not expansionist, really.
No, they're not.
They're
right.
more conservative, but they have a conservative view of Islam. And so I think that example is not going to be
right.
China, I would think, would be the better example.
But right, I was going to come to China. Right.
But
is China a communist power, or is it something evolving out of a communist? If it's a communist power, it will have the appetite for world historical domination.
Yeah, well, sometimes. I mean, if you go to Lenin, yes, back then, Lenin certainly did. But that kind of cooled with socialism in one nation with Stalin. And Stalin, you know, he was a hardcore communist as far as, you know, killing people. And, you know, he certainly didn't privatize the economy or come close, but he was more, he didn't want a war with the U.S. And I think the Soviet archives, when they were partially opened, indicated that he didn't, because he was scared of the United States. The United States had much more GDP than he did. And he had a big tank army, but we had a lot of air power that could have probably sort of a paper tiger. Now, as far as China goes, this guy now, that China was opening up to the West under Deng Xiaoping. And now we have...
And even internally under Deng Xiaoping.
Yes, yes. It's not a totally communist country anymore. But although I would say this, Xi is taking them back. And the one advantage of that, it's very unfortunate for the Chinese people, but that is going to impair his ability to be a military power, because I would say China is becoming a regional military power right now. But if I were him, I would think twice about invading Taiwan for a number of reasons. Number one, what the Ukrainians did to the Russian Navy, when they didn't even have a Navy with drones, both surface drones and air drones. And also, the Russian military was hollow. But, you know, Putin said, oh, I've redone this since the Soviet Union fell, and this is going to, you know, we're really going to be a great force. And, you know, they've gotten a little better as the war goes along by combat experience and stuff. But, Xi should be looking at the Russian military and going, gee, I don't know what rot is in my military. We have all this technology mm-hmm. and stuff, but if our military isn't, loyal, or it's not, they haven't told me all these problems because I'm a dictator.
Well, right.
What's the state of my military?
So Ivan, you know, I think that you're onto something. I'm pretty skeptical of both Putin and Xi for obvious reasons, but it seems to me you might be right that if what was on offer was a world historical sort of entente, as it were, with acknowledged and respected spheres of influence, even some of the worst actors might go for it. And if they did, then I can imagine your solution really working, namely scaling back. And in fact, scaling back the U.S. defense posture might make the new offer more enticing to the others, right, Ivan? So if all this worked out hypothetically, and we're looking now like the end part of your book, the book is called A Balance of Titans. At the end part of your book, you actually outline how U.S. defense expenditures could be scaled back. And I would like you to speak very briefly here at the end, Ivan, about how that could work, because we're not just talking here about like getting rid of $1,000 toilet seats, which is the famous military waste, you know, people talk about in the budget. You're talking about a lot more than that. How could we get from here to there, and how deep could the cuts go if this vision were implemented?
Well, I think you could get as much as 40%. Now you say, well, 40%.
40% is a lot.
Right. Well, we have a $1 trillion defense budget, and that's what the next 9 to 10 countries spend combined. Now, just think about that. And that is not only in 1 year. This spending gap has, with China and everybody else, has been decades in the making. And you get a lot of knowledge and technology during that period, so it's cumulative. And an example of that is, you know, the other countries, most of them don't have aircraft carriers, because launching planes from a floating platform and landing them safely is something that you have to learn over a number of decades, really. And so the spending is just unbelievable compared to other countries. And even if you took 40% of the budget, we would still be the largest defense spending country in the world. And very frankly, we're, of all great powers in human history, the U.S. may have the most secure intrinsic security. So do we really need to spend what we're spending? No, what we're spending is to be an interventionist superpower. And, you know, if even we have 40%, we're still the top dog, and we're away from the rest of the conflict zones. We have fairly weak and friendly neighbors, and we have the greatest nuclear arsenal on the planet. So, you know, we're pretty secure, even if we had a very small military.
So if the U.S. is maybe no longer going to be the world historical solo policeman, interventionist power, power of all powers, then your vision of reduction, intelligent reduction, starts to make a lot of sense. And I'm not going to ask you to walk us through the details, but I will assure our friends and viewers that in the last several chapters of his book, Ivan Neelan actually shows how it could be done intelligently, carefully, and with massive savings. So you've put a lot of work into this book, Ivan, and I'm really impressed. I want to remind people that if they want to take a look at the book, here it is, A Balance of Titans, Peace and Liberty in the New Multipolar World. And you can find this on Amazon and, of course, at independent.org. As we wrap up here, Ivan, are there some final like words of wisdom you'd like to toss in here before we say goodbye?
Well, there are problems which don't. Well, first of all, the powers can have boundary disputes. Even if they agree in addition, there can always be a boundary dispute. So you could, hopefully they can solve that amongst themselves. If they can't, they could take it to all these powers would be the UN Security Council would be expanded by probably at least three, India, Japan, and Germany, and maybe Brazil in the future. And they would take this, either the border disputes, or if they can't solve them themselves, to the UN Security Council for a discussion, et cetera. And or if there's transnational problems, like some countries really putting a lot of air pollution, it's going into another country, you know, something like that. I'm just making something up now, but, you know, the transnational problem, if there's lots of narcotics or whatever, but of course, you know, we like to say we can solve that by market means, but I'm just thinking of any transnational problem could also be brought before the UN Security Council.
If your idea catches on, it could have a really transformative effect on a lot of the apparently insurmountable issues that the U.S. faces overseas. So thank you for putting all the work in on this, Ivan. Much appreciated. And we wish you all the best as you continue to develop these ideas. And hopefully a lot of people will order this book and give it some serious thought, especially those maybe in the foreign policy establishment who need it most. Thanks again, Ivan, for all your work.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us on Independent Conversations here at Independent Institute. Just as a reminder, you can always go to our website, independent.org, for access to this book and other things of great interest. We try and keep a strong archive of tight analysis of national and world affairs on our website for all of our friends to avail themselves of. Thanks for joining us, everybody. See you next time.